listened to the Drew Marshall Show before?
George Bush is the Antichrist. Honest to God.
You think George Bush is the Antichrist?
Yes.
Okay, so George Bush is the Antichrist because he's a nice guy.
He's a nice guy. He's fooling people. He's a trickster.
Would you vote for George W. Bush?
Absolutely.
Why? He's the Antichrist.
I think the guy needs to read his Bible.
Would you vote for George W. Bush?
Absolutely. I hope he's not the Antichrist, because then I'm going to vote for the wrong guy.
Yeah, I hate when that happens.
The Drew Marshall Show, right here on Joy 1250.
You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Dr. David Jeremiah is the senior pastor of Shadow Mountain Community Church down there in California, which is where I used to live. And to be honest, today I was kind of still wishing I was down there. Dr. Jeremiah is the author of many books, including Discover Paradise, Life Wide Open, Searching for Heaven on Earth, My Heart's Desire, Grace Givers, and the best-selling Captured by Grace. His award-winning international radio and television ministry, Turning Point, reflects his commitment to the truth of the Bible and to helping people understand how to apply biblical principles to everyday living. TurningPointOnline.org is the name of the website, and his latest book, Why the Nativity? 25 Compelling Reasons We Celebrate the Birth of Jesus, is one of the many reasons he is joining us on the show today. So welcome to the Drew Marshall Show. Dr. David Jeremiah, thank you for yet another interview.
Well, thank you for having me. I know that I'm in a lot warmer place than you are, so I'm in good shape.
Thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate it. Just rubbing salt in the wound.
Yes.
Whereabouts in California are you?
Well, actually, we're in the East County, in San Diego East County, in the little village of El Cajon. The church is located, and Turning Point's headquarters is in Lakeside.
Lakeside, okay, I know it well. I was actually involved with a place called Hume Lake up in the mountains.
Oh, yes, I went there many, many times when my children were growing up and spoke at the Lakeview Conference.
You did too, that's right. That's right, back in the days of Kenny Poor.
That's right.
You don't see Kenny at all, do you?
Yes, he comes to speak for us every summer at our Bible conference. He's a great friend.
He's a lot better speaker than I think he was used car salesman, wasn't he?
Well, he's incorporated a little of that into what he does.
All right. Well, I want to take people right back to you, because probably the most of the interviews you do are about your books or about something new coming out or, you know, ministry related and et cetera, et cetera. I want people to understand who you are, because I got to be honest with you, and forgive me for saying this, but I know very, very little about you. And all I know is that February 13th, 1941, this little boy came into the world and has since been a world shaker. You've had quite an influence on the world. So take us back to Toledo, Ohio. What kind of family did you grow up in?
Well, my parents were in the ministry. My father was a Baptist preacher. I was born in Mercy Hospital in Toledo, Ohio. My dad at the time was the pastor of the Emmanuel Baptist Church in Toledo, and I lived there for 11 years, and my father took a ministry in Dayton, Ohio, and we moved there, and I was there for 2 or 3 years, and then my dad became the president of Cedarville College in Ohio, and that's really where I grew up from the fourth or fifth grade all the way through college, because I went to high school there, and then I went on to college at Cedarville. And while I was a junior in Cedarville College, I met my wife, Donna, and after graduation, we got married.
1963.
That's right.
It was a good year, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And then went immediately off to Dallas Seminary, where I spent 4 years working on a master's degree. And then in 1967, when we graduated, we went to the Haddon Heights Baptist Church in New Jersey, and I was a youth pastor and CE director for a couple of years. In 1969, I was called to start a church in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I went there, and with seven families, we planted what is now the Black Hawk Baptist Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I was there for 12 years, and the church grew to about 1,500. And then in 1981, through a series of rather strange events, Dr. Tim LaHaye resigned the Scott Memorial Baptist Church here in California, and I was called as the pastor. And I came in 1981, and I've been here now for 25 years.
Wow. Now, who do you think's making more money today, Dr. Tim LaHaye or Dr. David Jeremiah? That's what I really want to know.
I don't think there's a whole lot of question about that, Drew. Yeah,
he actually said on my show he's got more money than he knows what to do with. Can you imagine that?
Yeah. Well, I believe that he has certainly had a very successful after 80 life or after 70 life. I guess he just turned 80. In the years between his 70th and 80th birthday, the best things in the world happened to him.
So hang in there is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, don't quit.
Don't quit, man, no. BA from Cedarville College. Did you get into Cedarville because, I mean, that's where your dad was kind of the big kahuna at? Or
I did look at some other schools, and I had some scholarship offers in track and basketball, but ultimately decided to stay home and play basketball for Cedarville, and that's how I got there.
Now, you in the journey that you've just described to us, it almost sounds like a bit of a cakewalk. You know, I grew up in a Christian family, and my dad became the president of the Bible college thing here, and then I went to Bible college, and then I did the pastor thing, and then we did the ministry deal, and, you know, it just sounds like a smooth rolling ship. I'm sure you must have gone through some desert times, or were you one of those kids that, I don't know, God just seemed to have protected from all the nonsense of life?
Well, I'm really thankful that I didn't. I mean, I never drank. I never got into drugs. I didn't smoke. I mean, I didn't do all the things that are destructive to the human body. I tell you the truth, I'm not going to confess my sins on your show.
Oh, come on!
I wasn't a perfect person, and I had my challenges in my teenage years. But by the time I got to college and got into my studies there, I was pretty well along the way in terms of the Lord's direction in my life. My challenges in life came a bit later, in the fact that I had cancer twice and have been through that very difficult experience.
Well, can you share just briefly with our listeners? Again, we don't want to turn this into a sort of a Dr. Phil moment here, but
well, that's okay. I'm glad to share it. I was here in this church in 1994. I went for an executive physical. And the physicians discovered something in my abdominal cavity that wasn't supposed to be there, and we had all of the tests. I ended up at the Mayo Clinic. I had surgery there, exploratory surgery, and was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and came back here and went through chemo for several months and got into remission. And then 3 years later, in 1998, it returned. And at that time, I had a stem cell transplant, and for the last 8 years, I have been free of cancer.
Do you say praise God or praise the doctors or praise both?
Well, you know what? God does his best work through people, but I know that God's hand was on me. And, you know, I'm not a mystic, but it's one time in my life when I really did feel the prayers of God's people from all over the country, from around the world, wherever our television and radio program went. People prayed for me, and I'm really very grateful. I know that it was their prayer that got me back on my feet.
How did Donna handle all this?
Well, you know what? I wrote a book at the time I was coming out of this thing called A Bend in the Road, and Donna wrote the foreword to it. And I think what she wrote in the foreword pretty much summarizes how she dealt with it. She said, I decided to choose hope, and she did. And together we got through that. And, of course, if you're a pastor in a local church and with all the stuff we've got going here with schools and ministry and media and all that, there are other kinds of problems that sometimes seem like they're almost like cancer as well, but there's not anything that so drove me to the core of my faith like going through cancer.
Right, right. Folks, we are on the phone with Dr. David Jeremiah, just getting some insights into the man's life as well as his latest book, Why the Nativity, 25 Compelling Reasons We Celebrate the Birth of Jesus. We'll get to that momentarily. But, David, I get the impression that a lot of pastors' kids either go one way or the other. They either turn into like a Marilyn Manson and kind of go right off the deep end and don't want to have a bar of any of it, or they go the other way. They follow their daddy's footsteps. And you did the daddy's footsteps thing. Would you say there was a definitive moment, an absolute definitive moment where you owned your own walk with Christ as opposed to living off your parents' stuff?
Oh, yeah, there was. And I know when it was, exactly when it was and how it happened. And I was a freshman or a sophomore in college, and I had been not living for the Lord the way I should have been living for the Lord. And I had a moment where I realized that I didn't want to live on both sides of the street any longer, that either I was going to begin to really live for the Lord full out, or I was going to just walk away from it. And I chose to live for the Lord, and I've never regretted it. But I knew that I couldn't be duplicitous any longer. I was just, you know, it's very, very hard to live a double life. It's very emotionally draining. Yeah. I didn't want to do that anymore.
Yeah, that's quite my story as well. The double life scenario led me to a suicide attempt, actually. And well, I think you understand that. The double life thing, you can't pull off for very long.
Right. Now, you can't remember who you said what to. You can't remember who knows what about you. And so I'm thankful that the Lord brought me to that place. And at the same time, I'm also very grateful that over the years, even while I wasn't walking with the Lord, He was making inputs into my life through the opportunities I had to observe ministry. I often think as a pastor that I learned more just by absorbing what I watched go on around me than some guys learn by going to school. I had that advantage.
Yeah.
Some things are second nature to me that I see other guys struggle with, and I know that's just a gift from God.
Interesting. Thinking back to your DTS days, your Dallas Theological Seminary, isn't that Chuck Swindoll's...
That's where he is. Yeah, he's the president there now.
Right, right. Do you see Chuck at all very much?
I usually see him at the NRB, and sometimes I see him at the Christian Booksellers event. But our paths don't cross very much. Chuck doesn't travel a lot, and stays close to home. Yeah.
He's a homebody. Well, yeah. You're a bit of a homebody as well, though, aren't you?
Well, you know, I don't think that if you ask my family that, they wouldn't say that. I'm gone all the time. Every month I'm out at least a week somewhere doing something. I'm getting ready tomorrow, right after the morning service, to take off on a tour to speak in 4 military bases before Christmas to encourage the troops and the families. And we've distributed 100,000 copies of this book to the military, and many of the bases where this book has been received, I'm going to go and speak in their chapel and encourage the families. And I do that kind of stuff a lot.
Well, I got to ask you then, if you're traveling that much, the one thing I always wonder about, especially when it comes to spiritual leaders who are traveling or even just pastoring, because the local flock or the church kind of sucks the life out of them in many ways, unless you're very, very careful with your boundaries. Do you look back on you as a father and wonder how you screwed up Janice or David Michael or Jennifer or Daniel?
Well, you know what? I think I made some mistakes with Janice when she was here, but after my first child, and I began to realize at that time I was building the church in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I was visiting every night. I wasn't out of town very much. I was just out evangelizing and knocking on doors, and my wife and I had a moment of truth one time in the kitchen, and she just told me that, you know, that she knew that one day I was going to stand before the Lord and I would give an account of my ministry, but I was also the priest of this family. And that she didn't think those two things ought to be in conflict. And, you know, during the time my children were growing up, I didn't do what I'm doing now. I never missed any of their ball games or any of their events. And
good for you.
And one of the reasons why my kids are all my friends right now is they never felt like the ministry was a mistress. You know, they believed that I believed in them. And I've tried to create an atmosphere here at Shadow Mountain, even for staff people, where this is a family-friendly ministry.
Good for you. Good for you. At the risk of sounding like a condescending jerk, I mean, I'm proud of you for saying that. It does frustrate me when I see spiritual leaders neglecting their family. As a matter of fact, when I was hired as a pastor in Australia, I said to the search committee, keep your hands off my wife and kids. You know, you're hiring me. Very definitively.
Well, I don't think I've ever said it quite that in your face, but it, you know, when my wife and I came here to San Diego, you know, we followed Tim and Beverly LaHaye.
Oh, yeah, have fun doing that.
And she wanted everybody to know coming in the front door that she was not Beverly LaHaye, that
no.
She speaks in front of the congregation once a year, and that's when we do some narration at a Christmas thing we do, and that's it. She doesn't want to be in front of people, and she relishes the ministries that she has behind the scenes. Last night at our home, she hosted almost 40 military wives for their Christmas party and provided gifts and all kinds of things. And she loves that ministry. And the military wives that show up here because of where we are, they love her because she just cares about them. And when they have babies, she puts baskets together for them and we do. She loves doing that kind of stuff that's behind the scenes. She said one person in the limelight in our family is enough.
I have a wife very similar. Many people have said, why hasn't your wife come on your show? Because I don't have enough money to pay her to come on my shows.
Yeah.
That's one of the main reasons.
Yeah.
Well, let's go over your theological life or your spiritual life. When I think back on my spiritual journey, it certainly hasn't been as long as yours, but I know I've changed in my theology or my doctrinal understandings. And I remember asking Tim LaHaye this same question, and he said, no, you know, I really haven't changed that much as far as my theology and doctrines are concerned. Would you say something similar, or can you look back on your journey and go, boy, I lightened up, or I became less of a legalist, less dogmatic, or there's some eschatological viewpoint I totally flip-flopped on?
You know what? I think the biggest change for me, Drew, was I grew up in a very conservative environment. My father and the school that he was the president of and the churches he pastored were in the GARBC, which is somewhat of a separatist movement in the Baptist groups. And, you know, I don't think until I went to seminary at Dallas that I really was really certain whether anybody else was doing the will of God or not, except this group that I was in.
Right.
And when I got there and found out, first of all, that the school itself was Presbyterian in background, that many of the professors weren't Baptists, that they were making a difference in ways that I'd never even dreamed of before, I think it opened my eyes to the fact that no one denomination or group of people has a corner on God's perspective and God's power, and it just broadened my perspective in a way that I'm very thankful for that.
I remember hearing Billy Graham on Larry King when Larry always asks his guests, have you been on Larry King, by the way?
No, I haven't.
I think that'd be a great match.
Yeah.
I remember Larry asking Billy, and he asked all his Christian guests the same question, you know, if I don't believe in Jesus Christ, am I going to hell? He always tries to, you know, paint them in that corner. And I think Larry's is very, very much a spiritual seeker, just by the amount of Christian
right.
guests he has on the show
yeah.
and the questions. It's just
right.
tremendous. But I remember Billy saying, or Mr. Graham, saying something along the lines of, you know, Larry, all I can say is that without Jesus, there is no guarantee. Now, that would be a different answer than he gave 50 years ago, would you
yeah.
not say?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not sure which one of those is best on Larry King. I'll tell you, I think the best answer I ever heard to that question was when he interviewed Rick Warren.
Oh, yeah.
And Rick Warren said, you know, unfortunately, Larry, I don't get to make those rules.
That's good. I like it.
That's a good one because that kind of deflects, you know, what they're trying to do when they do that is to paint you in a corner of arrogance and political incorrectness
yeah.
and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's some others, and I won't name any names here, who've gone on there and have totally capitulated to the whole deal and embarrassed all of us. So there's an answer somewhere that's the right one without getting in his face and being rude to him. You
yeah.
still have to tell him that the Bible says that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through him.
Yeah, I wonder if Joel regrets that. Oh, sorry, was that out loud?
Yeah, I heard you.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Now, your children, are any of them in the game, or did you warn them away? You know, I've got, coming up in the show, I've got Ted DiBiase, who is wrestling's Million Dollar Man, and he said to his kids when they wanted to wrestle, a couple of his boys, don't get into the business. I mean, please. And yet they've gone ahead, a couple of them, and
yeah.
they've not heeded his advice. What say you about getting into the,
well,
the
Drew,
ministry?
I got to tell you, I got four kids, and here's what they're doing. My oldest daughter, Jan, is a designer for a major convention group here. She's one of the top designers in San Diego and does huge major parties for companies that come here. She did the Qualcomm party last year. She's in Cabo San Lucas right now doing a $1.8 million wedding, which is about as
bizarre. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. And so that's what she does. She's a worker of all workers. And unfortunately, this last year at the age of 33, discovered that she's got MS.
Oh, man.
She's doing well with it, and it's not aggressive, but it's not something. And then my oldest son, David, he is the vice president and director of operations of Turning Point Radio and Television, and he manages all the media stuff that we do here. And, you know, Turning Point's on 2,000 times a day in the States and in every country where Spanish is spoken. and we're on in every state on television, on the PAX network, and actually on the Vision network in Canada. And he manages all that and helps me not have to deal with all the details of that. My youngest daughter, Jennifer, is married and just had her first little girl. And before she got pregnant with that little girl, she was the dean of women at our college, San Diego Christian College. And now she's retired to be a full-time mom. And my youngest son, Daniel, is the West Coast scout for the Baltimore Ravens.
Nice.
So that's my family. I told them basically the same thing your next guest told here their kids. If God calls you to be a pastor or to go into ministry, I'll support it 100%, but I don't have those expectations. And I want you to do what God has called you to do. And whatever that is, I know you'll find a way to do ministry in the midst of it.
Somebody said to me, a wise man once said, God needs to drag you kicking and screaming into the ministry. There's too many people, you know, going to Bible college and coming out of Bible college, sort of floating their way into it and embracing it, not really knowing what they're getting into.
They don't understand the difference between a calling and a career.
Right.
And I face that a lot. I'm going through a little bit of that right now with a guy who, you know, he can't decide what he wants to do and who he wants to be and where he wants to go, and he doesn't know whether he's been called or he's working on a career, and it's so frustrating, and I feel so bad for him. My father told me something similar. He said, if you do not absolutely know that you're called to be a pastor, don't do it, because when the pressure's on, you'll quit.
You'll bail.
And there have been two times or three times in my ministry when I have said, Lord, I want out of here and I want out of this, but I won't go AWOL on you, so whatever you got in here, you got to show me what to do. And I think every guy who goes into ministry is going to face some times like that. And if his calling isn't clear, then it will be very hard for him to stay with it.
What are you bad at?
What am I bad at?
Yeah, what can you own some? Because right now you seem like the jack of all trades. You can kind of, and a lot of pastors think that they're good at everything. You know, especially the small church pastors where they're forced to do all these different positions.
Right.
Not until they get into one of the mega or giga churches do they get to delegate, you know, to somebody else and say, look, I suck at administration. Can you please take care of this?
I'm not a good counselor. Not because I don't care about people. I'm not patient enough. I don't do any counseling at all, except, you know, on a very rare occasion, I have counselors who take care of all that. And, you know, I know some guys are really good at that, and I just never have been.
I mean, look, on behalf of all the people out there who have been hurt by pastors who can't counsel, thank you for owning that.
The point of it is, people need folks who can hang in there with them and work through the issues. And, you know, I'm a solver, a problem solver, you know, and
right.
And so when I'm already thinking about what I think they should do before I even hear the whole issue, and
yeah.
It's just not fair to them. I am a counselor in the pulpit, and that's what I love to do. I'm a preemptive counselor in so many ways, and I think that's one of the things every pastor should do. I believe that we can keep people from falling over the cliff is a lot better than we can collect their remains at the bottom. And I like to preach, and I like to teach, and I like to find a way to help people. We have a group in our church called Celebrate Recovery.
Oh, great group.
Yeah, and they meet on Friday nights, and I spoke to them last night. There's 200 of them in this group now. And I gave a message, and then afterwards had a question and answer time, and so I did a little counseling last night, sitting up on a stool, listening to these people ask me all these questions. But I'm not a good, let's make an appointment and spend a couple hours together, sort through your problem. I just don't do that.
Yeah, good for you. And let me just give another plug for CR, Celebrate Recovery, a brilliant group. I think did that not get birthed out of Rick Warren's church mm-hmm. down there, Saddleback?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, good, a good scene for those who are struggling with addictions or hurts or habits or hang-ups. Yeah. I think that's their shtick.
Well, they make me introduce myself when I go there like they do. I have to say, hello, my name is David Jeremiah,
right.
And I'm a recovering workaholic.
Oh, yeah, there it is. There it is. That's what I wanted to hear. A little dirt, workaholic.
Yeah.
How does Dr. David Jeremiah handle the potential side effects of being Dr. David Jeremiah? And I'm talking about ego. You know, how do you stay level, aside from your wife keeping you level?
Well, I'll tell you what, anybody who truly enters into the pastoring of a church if he's really plugged into what's going on in a church and dealing with the issues day by day, it'd be pretty hard for him to get too caught up in who he is and what he does. you know what, I'm comfortable in my own skin, Drew. I know who I am. I know what I am not. And the thing that I think you need to be aware of is, as a pastor, is no matter what you've done or where you've been or what you've supposedly built, just look around the corner and there's somebody there who's done more and better and bigger and faster. And you know, if this whole thing that we're into is some sort of a race to see who can get to the top first, then you got an issue. But ministry is a day-by-day journey, and every day there's at least three or four things that happen to me that remind me who I am and that help me keep my feet on the ground.
Okay, so as outsiders to the game that you're in, I think a lot of us always cringe when one of you big spiritual kahunas kind of falls. Of course, we're talking about the Ted Haggard thing. I mean, what do you... I don't even know how to word this. What do you, other than the usual wage, which is what do you have in your life to make sure you don't turn into yet another Ted Haggard scenario?
Well, first of all, for anybody to say that they won't ever do that is to violate the principles that are given to you in the Scripture to protect you, and that is, let him that thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. My observation about this is a distant viewer is that the Bible is absolutely to the point when it says pride goes before a fall. Arrogance in any of our lives is the first step toward believing our own press. Even I think I heard Ted Haggard say in one of his interviews, he got to the point where he felt like he could live like this and live, and he was above all of it. That he could live this way and not be held accountable like other people. That's pride. That's arrogance. And I'm not being disrespectful to him anyone else.
No.
I have one of my mentors at Dallas Seminary was Howard Hendricks, and I remember him saying, and when he came to speak at our church one time to a group of leaders, that he carried a little book around in his pocket, and in this book he wrote down the names of students and fellow pastors and folks that he knew who had fallen in ministry. And at that time that he made this comment, I think he said he had 101 names in his book.
Wow.
And he said when he looked through the names and tried to find what was common among these people, the one thing that he felt was true of all of them, except maybe seven or eight that he wasn't really acquainted with, was that they were proud and arrogant. And I'll tell you the truth, there are a lot of opportunities to do that if you want to. I mean, just the very thing we're doing right now. If you think that you're so important that you got to be on somebody's television show or radio show and it's about you, it can bury you.
Well, you certainly show your humility just by being on my show. So.
So. Well, it's not so much about being on your show, Drew. It's about it being 10 o'clock on Saturday morning.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. All right. The city of Berkeley, Michigan is currently in debate after the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, charged that the presence of a nativity scene is an unconstitutional endorsement of Christianity and thus offensive to residents who are not of the Christian faith. In Denver, a church was banned from the city's 2004 Festival of Lights parade because it wanted a Christian religious theme to its float, and in 2004, a New Jersey school banned even instrumental versions of traditional Christmas songs. I got to chuckle at that one because the instrumental version thing is just goofy. And finally, Arizona school officials ruled it unconstitutional for a student to make any reference to the religious history of Christmas in a class project. And of course, the piece de resistance was the Walmart fiasco last year, in which they've come around and said to everybody, Merry Christmas, you know, knock yourselves out. You know, last year, David, on the show, I phoned some of these stores live on air just to see how they would answer.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody from Walmart said, Merry Christmas. And I said, hey, wait a second, you're not supposed to say that. And she said, oh, fooey with that.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the most ridiculous one is one that's going on right now. And I've been on the phone with some of the guys who are involved in the producing of this film that just came out Friday or last night. And I don't know if you've read the stuff that happened in Chicago with the... Listen to this. The Christerland Fellowship, or Christerland Festival, which is, I probably haven't said that quite right, but it's a German festival that's been going on there for years.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the name Christ in the name of the festival, and they banned any showing of the nativity story to encourage people to go see it.
That's goofy.
And yesterday in the Sun-Times in Chicago, there's a cartoon, and it shows Mayor Daley standing there with Joseph and Mary on their donkey, and he's got he's got his finger pointed toward him saying, get out of town.
Oh, no.
To the Sun Times. I mean, it's so crazy. And I think that most American people, I read a great piece by Ben Stein, who's a Jew, and he said he has never been offended by anything that represents the true meaning of Christmas. That even for a person who's not a Christian, who's a Jew or a Muslim, it represents the highest level of life. It represents love. And he went on this long diatribe about how this is the stupidest thing that's ever happened in America, and let's get back to what this is all about. If we're not going to celebrate Christmas, let's take the name off of it. I mean, that's the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life.
You're really passionate about this, aren't you?
Well, I am. And, you know, one of the reasons I got involved in this project with the Nativity book was I said to some of our guys here, you know, it's time for us to take Christmas back. Let's do what we can do to help people understand that the real story of Christmas is so far better than anything anybody's made up since. Why would you want to do it?
Yeah.
You know, the story of the Nativity, and I've seen the film three times, it beautifully presents the birth of Jesus. And it shows the miracle that happened that started Christmas in the first place.
Well, of course, this book that you've got here, Why the Nativity, 25 Compelling Reasons We Celebrate the Birth of Jesus. Ideally, what's the plan with this book? Is this supposed to be a decent maybe Christmas gift to give to somebody who doesn't know the whole Jesus thing and say, here's the whole story?
Well, you know, the book has got 25 chapters. It was sort of designed for people to read a chapter a day for the month of December and then, you know, finish it up on Christmas Day. And it answers questions that people have asked over the years. I've been preaching on Christmas for 40 years, and over the years, these are various questions that have been asked that are to the heart of the real meaning of the story. And so this book was crafted to, in some respects, kind of as a backdraft to the film and fill in some of the empty places. The film itself is not a doctrinal treatise. It just shows the story. The book answers some of the questions that are behind the story that are of great meaning.
I love the question why. As a matter of fact, I was actually kicked out of a school for asking why too much in grade 7. I just asked why all the time. And that's the way you've labeled these chapters. 25 chapter titles. Why the prophecies? Why did God become a man? Why Mary? Why the Song of Mary? Why Joseph? Why did Jesus come when he did? Why Elizabeth and Zechariah's miracle baby? Why Bethlehem? Why was there no room at the inn? Why the stable? Why call him Jesus? And why was Jesus born of a virgin? It just keeps going and going and going. And I love the way you've broken this down.
Well, and we tried to do it. You know, the chapters are like 1,000 words. They're easy, but we got to the core of the answers. And then, of course, you get to the end of the book, and the last chapter is, so why should I believe in this Jesus? When we had, we took 3,000 of our people to the premiere of this film the night before last, and many of them were bringing their unsafe friends with them, and we wanted to have a track that we could use just to give everybody when they came out. And so what we did is we took the last chapter out of that book and created a little tract out of it with the gospel. It's got a prayer in it. People can pray to receive Christ. And my prayer is that the book will be kind of an evangelistic tool that God uses to help people draw the line between the cradle and the cross, because that's what Christmas is all about.
All right, let's just talk about specifically one of the whys right now. Why do we celebrate Christmas on the 25th? Everyone goes, that's a pagan holiday. You know, stole it from the pagans.
There is no way that you can make any kind of definite line between the 25th of December and the birth of Jesus. It's pretty evident from studying the records that Jesus was not born at that particular time of the year. It came down as a holiday that was ultimately taken over by the celebration of Christmas and the birth of Christ, and over the years it has become just the day that we set apart to remember the birth of Jesus and to celebrate this day as his birthday, even though scholars know that this is very unlikely that he was actually born on the 25th of December. The point that needs to be understood, though, Drew, is that it's not whether or not it is the actual day of his birth, but it's about the fact that there is a day that we set aside to honor the Savior who came into this earth, to this world. It's kind of like what I tell people when they ask me about their own spiritual birthday. sometimes a friend will say to me, you know, I think I'm a Christian, but I can't remember the day. I don't have it written in my Bible. I said, well, you know what? It's not important that you remember what day it was.
Good for you.
It's just important that you remember that there was a day.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, I think, kind of what's going on with this. That's the most untheological question in the whole book.
Well, that's why I picked it.
I figured that, yeah.
All right, 25 Reasons Why We Celebrate the Nativity. It's called Why the Nativity by Dr. David Jeremiah. Of course, this is the Turning Point Man. Quite a ministry you have. I appreciate it, you know, the time you've spent with us, sharing a little bit of your life. And I'm also very appreciative that you've, it seems like you're tackling this, and I hesitate using this phrase, the war on Christmas, because it's, I don't know, that just seems a bit overreactionary.
Well, it's not overreactionary. I mean, I really believe that if we don't do anything to stand up to this thing, we don't have any reason to complain about it. And I just think it's time that we can say, look, this has been our practice for as long as this country has been in existence. And it's all right if other people want to come here and celebrate their holidays, but they don't have the right to come here and tell us we can't celebrate ours.
Yeah.
That's the thing I get so frustrated about. You know, you want to celebrate
Ramadan
or whatever else, you go ahead and celebrate it, but in the process, don't create a culture that says, now you can't celebrate yours any longer either. I just don't buy that, and I think if Christians don't stand up and say stuff about it, that we're just going to let it roll over us, and then it'll be too late. We'll look back and wonder what happened. So I, in my own way, and the only way I know to do is through preaching and writing, I've wanted to have a part in celebrating this holiday with the producers of the film and having a part in this little book. And you know, the book, we could have made this into a hardcover gift book, but we made it into a paperback mass-produced book for $10, so people can get it. Or in Canada, it's probably more than that. I can't remember what the change is, but you know, it's not done so that we can make a lot of money on the book. It's done so that the book can get into the hands of a lot of people, and hopefully people will buy copies of it and give it to their friends and use it as a witnessing tool.
For
if that
sure.
happens, then I'll be fulfilled.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and I'll just leave you with this. Last week, I went down to one of our big theaters in Toronto and watched the Rockettes' Christmas special.
Oh, yeah.
What a tremendous evening. Very colorful. And if you have a hard time getting into the Christmas mood, folks, go down and see this thing. It'll drag you kicking and screaming into the Christmas mood.
We're taking our whole family to New York the week of Christmas to see that.
Oh, good for you. Well, here's the closer on this.
Oh, I know.
Is you think the thing's almost over, and all of a sudden everything goes dark, and an announcer comes on and says, there are many traditions we celebrate at this time of the year. Please allow us to give you our interpretation of one of the more famous traditions. That, you know, politically correct, okay, fine. But they worded it perfectly, and then boom, they launch into one of the sharpest nativity performances I've ever seen in my life, including live donkeys, live camels, live sheep, and a huge entourage of everybody worshiping the Lord Jesus. And then the screen comes down, and this all these words go up on the screen, and the narrator reads it, and basically what it's saying is Jesus is a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, they put one solitary life up there, which is amazing.
I don't tell anybody this, okay? Just between you and me, I was crying.
Yeah.
It kicked me. It was amazing.
It's a great thing, and they'll do the same thing over and over and over again in Radio City Music Hall in New York. We've seen it three times, and the last time I told my wife, I am not coming back to this unless I can bring our children and our grandchildren.
Oh, good for you. Good for you.
We cashed in all our miles.
That's right.
And well, we're going to New York.
Well, as you're walking past first class, maybe say hello to Joel and Mrs. Olstein for me, okay?
All right.
Dr. David Jeremiah, author of Why the Nativity, 25 Compelling Reasons We Celebrate the Birth of Jesus. I appreciate your time. It has just been an absolute honor to speak with you.
Thank you, Drew.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, David. Good guy. Good guy, good book. Dr. David Jeremiah. www.turningpointonline.org. Turningpointonline.org. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, our first talkback segment of the day. Do you agree with the decision of a Christian school to kick one of their students out because her mother was a stripper? We'll be right back.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.